Okay, I guess we'll open our meeting of the Rural Communities and Economic Development. Today is February 28th, 2013. Okay, I guess the first order of business today is we'll be hearing some bills. So we'll open the public hearing for Senate Bill 465. Anne, do you want to give us a little summary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 465 authorizes local governments with land use jurisdiction over residential improvements that sustain substantial flood-related damage to cause recordation of substantial damage in Office of County Clerk. It also authorizes the buyer of substantially damaged property to bring a cause of action against the seller for treble damages if the local government did not cause the notice to be recorded and the seller of the property did not disclose the substantial damage in the property disclosure statement.
So it looks like we have testimony today. We will give Senator Johnson. Bring her on up.
Mr. Chair, by your leave, may we come up as a triumvirate?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson, and I'm the state senator from District 16. It is from District 16 that this bill arises. And as many of you know, the little community of Vernonia was hit by two 500-year floods in just slightly more than a decade. Both created substantial damage in the town. We have pioneered in Vernonia the discovery of some problems in helping people restore their properties and their lives, and this bill arises from an actual situation. I'm joined here today by Jim Tierney, who is the head of our community action team, resides in Vernonia, but mostly was one of the local volunteer heroes who have helped try to put that town back together again. And he has become, I think, to his liking, way more familiar with FEMA's rules and regulations than he ever dreamed he would be. We're also joined by DLCD, and that's incredibly important. They're here in support of the bill. This bill may end up being slightly more of a work in progress than we had anticipated, as the Dash 3 amendments just came streaking into the room. And I'm not sure that even we have had a chance to look at them, but we would like to present to you the case for the bill. And we may ask your indulgence to come back before you again. I want to thank your committee administrator for her patience in helping work through some of the other technical issues in the bill. But with that, I'm going to surrender the microphone to Jim Tierney, and he will lay out the case for why this is an important bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jim Tierney. I live in Vernonia, Oregon. Senator Johnson laid out nicely, there are some recovery problems that we ran into in Vernonia, and specifically, this bill is designed to solve one of them. And I'm going to have to get into some weeds a little bit so you understand that, but the way in which flood insurance is funded for most people in this country is through FEMA. And they buy it from their ordinary insurance agent, but FEMA subsidizes about two-thirds of the cost. You probably noticed that when you saw the disaster that we had on the East Coast this year. In order to limit their cost, FEMA has asked communities, in order to be eligible for flood insurance, that they pass an ordinance, a development ordinance, that would allow the community to regulate how people build and develop in the floodplain. And in this particular case, the floodplain, that began to happen in 1988. So we have some homes that predate that, so they are grandfathered in. There are others where communities might not have been too diligent with that. And then there are others where, like in Vernonia, we've just raised the level of our base flood elevation in our development ordinance. So you have another higher standard than we used to have when homes were built. So in the case of those non-compliant homes, the development ordinances FEMA requires say that if the property is, open quote, substantially damaged, close quote, the owner has to elevate the home move it on the property, or tear it down within, I think, 4-year period. And the city is left with the enforcement problem to make that happen under threat that the whole community will lose flood insurance. So that's the problem in a nub. Generally, what we had in Vernonia, we had 240 homes that were substantially damaged, and we had trouble with only about half a dozen, maybe 9. And trouble in this case would be where the owner didn't either responsibly do the right thing just because they had insurance or whatever. In some cases, what happened is an unscrupulous owner sold the property to someone who didn't know what they were doing, and it was sold for a song. The person thought they were getting a great deal. There's a great example that we have that I won't get into the details of, but this person got a $30,000 insurance settlement, took all the money to buy what she thought was probably a $150,000 house. Now she can't get power and water turned back onto the property, and she's left there stuck in the home with nothing to do. So that's generally the problem we're trying to solve. And we're hoping to solve it with notice. When we were in the middle of issuing our substantial damage letters, which the community, either the city or county, has to do, we thought, well, there's going to be some of these that we knew were problems from the beginning. And we thought, what we'll do is we'll go record. If we think the property's in foreclosure or something else, we'll go record it at the county. I was surprised that they basically tossed us out and said it's not legal for you to record this document. So that's what this bill does, is it makes it legal for us to record, for a community record, a standard notice of substantial damage. And the intent in some of the amendments to this bill would be that there would be a corresponding document once the property has been repaired, elevated, or demolished that would remove the notice of substantial damage. In addition to that, there is an attempt to increase the damages someone could claim. Ordinarily, if you buy a home and let's say it has termites and you knew it and didn't tell the new purchaser, they can sue you after the fact. You sign a warranty at closing. In this case, it trebles the damages there to make it more feasible for people to get someone out of state or to chase someone down. Again, the people buying these homes would be really on the edge. With an elevation, you can imagine if someone bought a home and then had to tear it down, it's a complete loss for them. But even an elevation doesn't sound so bad until you realize that after doing 40 of them in Vernonia, they run $50,000 to $100,000 to elevate a home. So it's a big deal. It's a big loss. And that's the reason for the bill. And it's really not a lot more complicated than that. So.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Matt Krall on staff at the Oregon Department of Land Conservation Development. I'm here today to say we support this bill. It adds an additional tool for local governments to use, but it does not create any new requirements for local governments. So that's definitely important. And it does not put any additional restrictions on property owners beyond what the local ordinances already apply in the floodplain areas. As we've been working on it, though, we do have a few things that we're still trying to work out in terms of keeping a consistent definition between what FEMA defines as substantial damage and what locals have adopted as substantial damage and what then we define here. And just in looking at the dash 2 and 3 as it came out today, one little question about how to look at the trigger for recording the void. If you record a notice of a damage, then there has to be another document that gets recorded later to say, hey, it's all repaired. I think we need to work on the language a little bit there. Unfortunately, our staff expert on floodplain matters is meeting with FEMA this week and the counterparts from other states. And so if we could have another week to work on getting some language cleared up before we have the work session on this, that would be great. We'd love to have this bill passed here in support.
Any questions?
Nope.
Well, I have a couple. Since I live in a floodway, so we're dealing with floodway, floodplain, the question I have is that, so when you have a flood go through and it does some damage to a house, at what point can you just repair the house, no big deal, and at what point do we have to, you know, re-elevate the house so the living floor is 1 foot above the 100-year floodplain and that?
Thank you, Chair. Bertschinger?
I'm going to send you to Courtney's office.
Okay. And members of the committee. The answer to your question depends on the color of money being used to repair it.
Okay.
So, for example, in the recovery in Vernonia, we used some public sources. And in the floodway, as your home is, at this point in time, during in the middle of our recovery, an interpretation came from Washington that said, thou shalt not ever touch anything in the floodway with public money, with federal money. So if it's private money, then the regulation typically, and again, it depends on your local organization's model development ordinance, but what FEMA requires and wants in those ordinances is that you have to, if you expand the footprint of the home being repaired or elevated, then you would need to show that you are not raising the water level more than, I think, a foot or an inch or something up the river.
Do a high-rise study.
Right, right. So there's a $4,000 or $5,000 study that has to be done if you're increasing the size of the footprint. But I think generally most ordinances will allow you to put the home back together within the same footprint in the floodway. The floodplain is much, much easier to work with than the floodway.
But do they make you raise it up, though? That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, then the question is whether or not the structure was substantially damaged. And the measure we used in Vernonia, which I think is the typical measure, and perhaps Matt can correct me with a statewide view, is that whether or not 50% of the structure on the property was damaged. So if you have a $150,000 home, the value of the lot and improvements are $50,000, your home is worth $100,000. If you spend $50,000 in $1 to repair it, then you have to elevate the home. That's the general rule we use.
And FEMA just did the gave you a new flood elevation to help you out?
Yeah, let me just correct that. And the 100-year floodplain is way spongier than people think. What it represents is an analysis by computers that the Corps of Engineers uses. And I was just talking with Matt this earlier, that it's a computer model. It breaks down in places like Vernonia where you're near the headwaters and where you have rivers that are the same length. And so it's much riskier. So what can happen is in our case, after the 2007 flood, FEMA did a terrific job of coming in immediately and asking the Corps to draw us a new map based on new evidence and raised our base flood elevation by a couple feet. And then the city agreed to add 3 on top of that because we didn't trust the model. And so that's the trick. Kind of depends on your local community and what their regulations are, but you have to go at least by FEMA's minimum standard, 1 foot above the base flood elevation, right, which is the 100-year plain.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Just a quick question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Jim,
for those of us that are uninformed, to raise it, are you talking about jacking up the house and adding layers to the foundation?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, exactly. That typically you have to put a new foundation underneath it. There are some regulations. We can really get into the weeds here. FEMA has a lot of rules about the foundations. But in essence, you've got it exactly right.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, Senator Close, that sounds easier. I discovered that the words belie how complicated it is. Let's presume that you had an elderly person who is required to lift their home. Now all of a sudden it has very steeply raked steps, and so there's the additional expense of having to build a ramp. These are expensive and complicated maneuvers that can only be done by a handful of experts to lift a house. That's why I see this bill as much as anything a consumer protection. There were a lot of very unsophisticated, and I don't mean this as a pejorative, but just people that didn't know the rules in Vernonia. And as they're trying to put their lives together at a point where they are especially vulnerable, and this could happen in any place that had a flood. We just happen to be experts about it in Vernonia because we've done it so many times. You have unscrupulous owners selling homes without the need to disclose. You have people who tried to put their lives back together again and discovered expenses that transcended any of their imagination. And as all we're trying to do is to shine a little light on on the condition of the house so that we don't have the kind of fact scenario that was manifest in Vernonia where a family bought a house and they ended up not being able to have power extended to it. Nobody disclosed along the way. She's in a home, or was, she's so subsequently had to abandon the house, but she's in a place that they can't extend city services to, and was desperate for money, having just survived a flood. I mean, this is a terrible situation. So I really see this as a consumer protection bill. It's a small but mighty bill for those handful of people that are going to be affected by the labyrinth of regulations in FEMA, again, at a time in their lives when they've just experienced a flood, and they're pretty vulnerable to begin with.
One more question. So I guess it's starting to get clear in my very simple brain. But what this would basically do is that would show up on a title report when you get into escrow.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, exactly. And again, the important thing that Matt pointed out earlier I missed was that this is voluntary on the part of the city. We didn't have to issue 240 notices and record them. Only the half a dozen where we knew we were going to have problems.
Okay, if there's no other questions. Okay, I think we will close this hearing on Senate Bill 465. And we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 496.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll work with your staff to get this ready for prime time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Okay. Senator Przanski, I guess you're up first.
Yeah, let's see if Rachel wants to.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Do the summary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 496 requires monies in the county road fund expended for patrolling to be used for direct and indirect patrolling costs. It defines direct costs, indirect costs, as well as patrolling.
So this bill, Senate Bill 496, is coming before us to get some clarification as to what has already been previously done. Basically, back in 2007, there was an opportunity that at that time, Representative Susan Morgan, who's now County Commissioner in Douglas County, and I co-sponsored a bill that would allow and did allow for Lane County and Douglas County to use some of their road funds for patrolling on the highways in the rural areas, and that was based on both of those counties at the time having a significant amount of reserve funds in those accounts to be able to be used. And so based on what we did in 2007, it did have a sunset clause that was set to go, I guess I believe, until 2014. And then as the background reflects, in 2011, we extended the sunset for a couple more years. And then as we start seeing the economy changing for a number of other counties that had some of the same monies available to them in their own road fund accounts, they asked to be included, and so we added an additional five counties. What happened after that, that was last year during the short session, one of the unions that represents Lane County Public Workers chose to, let's say, have an extremely narrow interpretation of what those funds could actually be used for. And if I remember correctly, Alex Kyler is here. He can fill in the blanks, but I believe that they asserted that a literal reading of patrolling meant that it only could go for the actual deputies out on the road and what they were doing, and that you couldn't basically give them the support that's necessary to have a patrol out there. And in other words, using a little bit of the money on a proportionate level for dispatching those officers, for the equipment and some of the equipment that they use, and other types of, let's say, necessities, part of the tools that they need to actually be able to actually patrol and do their job in those areas. So what we decided to do at this point was, I believe the intent, since I was one of the originators of the bill, was to make certain that they could actually have all the tools that are necessary to actually have an effective patrolling, to come back this time and actually specifically state what the definition of patrolling is, and ensuring that all of these, let's say, necessary connective services for a patrol officer to do his or her job is able to be done with the use of those funds. So with that, I guess, Mr. Chair, if you'd be so kind to have Alex Kyler come up.
Yep. Alex Kyler, Lane County. Jumping on my water today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I see the Senator Brzezinski didn't get the memo about the clothing today.
So. Oh, sure.
Sorry.
Purple Thursday. He's clothed. He's got a purple bracelet on.
What can I say? Yeah. I got what would David do bracelet. So.
Well, thank you very much, members, for hearing this bill. Really not too much more to add from what Senator Brzezinski explained here. This is a provision that goes back to 2007, but the underlying principle of the federal forest dollars coming to the county for road funds goes clear back to about 1905, when the federal forests were just being formed into the national forest system. So a little bit different revenue distribution from the ONC lands, but nonetheless important for Lane County. Lane and Douglas are the two highest recipients of those kinds of dollars in the nation. Douglas has a little bit more ONC land. Lane has a little bit more Forest Service land. The bill has been very useful for Lane County over the last several years, going back now 5-6 years. We've transferred on average about $2 million a year to the Sheriff's Department. And as Senator Brzezinski indicated, we did have some troubles during our budget committee hearings last time, to the point where the Senator actually came and testified as to some legislative intent during those hearings. And so rather than have him come every single time we have to put together a budget, this seemed like a good idea to just really clarify, I think, what has been the intent behind the bill all along, which is to suggest that a deputy is out there and there are supporting requirements from uniform, vehicle, dispatch is the big one, and the officer just doesn't exist in a vacuum. And so this just clarifies in our mind the legislative intent that has always been there, without being trying to not be too overly prescriptive about every single dime that gets spent.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alex, I have one question about the bill in line 10, section 1, subsection 4, subsection 1. You're taking out county roads and you're replacing it within the county. So I'm wondering, does that mean that you could patrol I-5 because it's within the county, or before it was just held to county roads, correct?
Chairman Bartschiger and Senator Close, actually, you know, that's funny because I was looking at that provision as well earlier today, and through the iterations of this measure that the Senator described, we've had it described a couple different ways about patrolling, and does it really mean the only county highways? Would it mean other roads? And I think that this wasn't necessarily something, that language that you just pointed out on line 10 wasn't something that we had come up with as we were working with LC. I saw that as more of a clarification that LC suggested, as if you had read that the way they take the language out right now, you might say, okay, then you must suggest that a deputy could be reimbursed only for that period of time they're actually on a county-owned and maintained road. That would be very difficult for us to track and account for. And so I think the drafter of the bill suggested, yeah, within any roads within the county, whether they were a city road, a county road, a state highway, I-5, yes.
Forest Service Road.
Forest Service Road, exactly.
Follow-up. So I'm assuming that there would be other statutes that would clarify what the State Patrol, what their authority is on certain roads. Is that true? I mean, you know, we used to see the Marion County Sheriff out on I-5 giving tickets, and I understand that's caused some problems.
Sure. And I think we were, you know, I think the purpose here was to suggest that we were defining rural patrolling only for the purposes of this transfer, because we didn't want to get into the whole issue of the criminal code and how a police officer may or may not function and where they have authority, that sort of thing. So it's really just, to me, meant for the purposes of these road fund transfers, which are very limited, obviously.
Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. To follow up with Senator Close, basically what we want to ensure is that the roads that are within the jurisdiction of the county can be patrolled, and it doesn't matter who or what designation the road is. And looking at the definition that's in 801.305 for highway will actually give us that perspective. And clearly it was never the intent to say that these would be for only funds to be distributed to county roads. As you can imagine, the most of the rural roads are not quote-unquote county roads. They're a combination. And that does include both state, some U.S. highways in the sense of that may not be the interstate. It could be the interstate. But then more importantly, I think, as the chair has said, where you have these areas that are Forest Service roads or other federal secondary roads, where you would, in fact, see a lot of this rural patrolling occur.
And private roads. Okay, any other questions? Does anybody else have any testimony for Senate Bill 496? Thank you. So we'll close the public hearing for Senate Bill 496, and we will open the public hearing for Senate Bill 517, and we have a summary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 517 allows a governing body of a public body owning land in approved or proposed diking or drainage district to appoint a designee to act on behalf of and represent the public body to exercise the rights of landowner in the district. And this includes serving on the Board of Supervisors.
So we have Mr. Wagner. Please state your name for the record.
Chair Berkshire, members of the committee, my name is Reed Wagner. I am the executive director of the Multnomah County Drainage District. I also serve three other districts in the area along the Columbia River and include Peninsula Drainage District Number 1, Peninsula Drainage District Number 2, and the Sandy Drainage Improvement Company. We're a flood protection organization and that serves about $20 billion of property, and that's public and private property. We have quite a bit of public property in our area. We have the Portland International Airport, the Portland Water Wells, city parks, the Exposition Center. And we are currently facing some pretty sizable challenges. We have a recertification process that we're going through that will have significant impact to the communities. It's both financial and social. We have some governance issues that we want to work through and some long-term funding. And we rely heavily on our boards. Our boards are made up of business representatives from the area, residents, and public agencies. The public agencies we have on our boards right now are interpreting the statute differently as to whether or not they need to send a board member to serve on our board, or they can send a staff person to serve on our board. And with these fairly sizable challenges that we have ahead, we want to make sure that the public agencies can send the person they think that will be able to serve our board and their board best. Sometimes that's somebody with more technical knowledge, and sometimes it's much more at a policy level. So this bill is was drafted to create some clarity and allow these public organizations to feel comfortable sending whoever they think is appropriate.
Questions?
I guess one question.
Sure.
And that basically, I understand for this will allow for designees to be to appear. Would this designation, I'm assuming, could change from meeting to meeting as to having a particular person, maybe for a specific topic? Are we talking about having someone with continuity, but then still having other people coming in and giving testimony?
Chair Bertschiger and Senator Brzezanski, the way the election process works is they would designate before the election, and that designee would serve the entire term,
okay,
a three-year term.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Anybody else want to testify on Senate Bill 517? Well, I guess we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 517. Do we have any other business?
I have none, except for knowing if I guess our next meeting will be our regular time, next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, 3 o'clock. And I believe Senator Rolbloom will be back.
Maybe with a couple of twins?
I don't think so. But with a big smile on his face. No other business?
No.
With there being no other business, we will adjourn this meeting of the Rural Communities and Economic Development.